Good morning. All right. Well, I'd like to begin this morning by first establishing some common ground. If you are like me, you might be a parent who is raising one or more children. Now, obviously, some of you here aren't parents, don't have children, but if you're like me, you might have been a child who was raised by one or two parents. In either case, I have no doubt that you have been on at least one, maybe both sides of this parent-child relationship. And as a result, you have likely experienced a common parent-child dynamic wherein the parent teaches the child to do work. Now, this is not always the most pleasant experience. Sometimes it's accompanied by grumbling and complaining, sulking, sometimes tears, perhaps even weeping and wailing. And sometimes your wife has to step in and say, "Steve, calm down. It'll be okay." And it can be rough on the kids too. As my daughter is growing up, one of my goals as a parent is to help her to develop a good work ethic. There are practical skills that I want her to acquire, like how to do laundry, how to cook, how to clean, how to use basic tools, etc. Basically, all the skills that will enable her to excel at life as an independent adult and hopefully as a wife and mother one day. But more important than how to do particular tasks, I want her to be willing to work without complaint. I want her to work hard and do a good job, not cutting corners or doing the bare minimum. I want her to care about the result, not just do it because she's being made to do it. I want her to follow through with jobs that have been assigned to her and do them without needing to be reminded. And I want her to pay attention to the world around her, to recognize opportunities where she can bring about improvement and take the initiative to do it. So as I go about pursuing this goal, I also think about, well, what is it that motivates a person to work? Why should she care about these things? Why should you care? And these are the questions that I would like to explore this morning. What does God tell us about work? What is the purpose and goal of work, and why should we do it? I think we can all agree that Christians should be good workers, but let's unpack what we really mean by that and how we can motivate each other towards that. When we talk about work, what activities do we have in mind? What is work? Is work just a means to an end, like putting food on the table? If that's the case, then is work defined as simply whatever activity makes that possible? In other words, is work synonymous with how you make a living? Or do we need a better definition? Once we have a definition of what work is, the second question is, what should motivate us to work? Do we work out of necessity? Is survival our primary motivation? Do we work because God says we should? Is our motivation simply a matter of obedience? Or is there a deeper purpose that we can use as motivation to spur us on in this endeavor that we call work? The world is a bit bipolar on the topic of work. On the one hand, we do celebrate and respect those who are hard workers. We honor the first responders, those who do the dirty jobs, the difficult jobs, the jobs that require extensive training, the jobs that are high risk. But on the other hand, we buy t-shirts, bumper stickers, and coffee mugs with slogans that make light of laziness, treating it almost as if it's a virtue or at least something to find amusing. I'm not lazy, I just don't like work. And full confession, I actually own that Snoopy t-shirt. My excuse is that it's my Sabbath shirt. Popular songs suggest that work just gets in the way of doing what we would prefer to be doing, like playing the drums or living it up on the weekends, dancing, partying, and finding romance. That's when we're free. That's when the good times are. Work is seen as bondage, drudgery, or at best, a necessary evil that allows us to get the funds we need so we can go out and have some fun. Now, as Christians, we know that work is not something to be avoided. God wants us to work, and he wants us to be good workers. But we still have a tendency to view it as an obligation that, if we're honest, we'd rather not have to do. We know we're supposed to work because God says to, and work is the means that God has ordained by which we put food on the table and a roof over our heads. But won't it be nice when we get to heaven and we won't have to do it anymore? Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but the biblical evidence suggests that we will actually be working in the age to come. Not because there will be problems to solve or incomplete tasks to be finished, but because there will be no end to the increase of God's glory. Revelation 22, the final chapter of the Bible, closes with an image of the tree of life, evoking the memory of the original garden before Adam and Eve sinned and lost access to the tree of life. In this perfect future environment, reminiscent of the environment where God originally gave Adam and Eve the charge to tend and cultivate the Garden of Eden, we're told that we will serve God and we will rule over the earth. So what's a servant do? A servant works. And a ruler oversees work done by others. So there was work before the curse in the Garden of Eden, and there will be work after the curse has ended in the New Jerusalem. This being the case, if work is part of God's perfect creation, both in the past and in the future, then it behooves us to make sure that we have a proper view of what work is and why we should view it as something good, not just something to be endured. Have you ever talked to someone who's not working and they say something like this, or maybe you've said something like this: I'd be happy to work, but no one has given me a job to do. I'm willing to work. I could do a good job if someone would hire me. Now, on the one hand, this is understandable because we have a tendency to equate work with employment. But I also think that in many cases, this mindset represents a misunderstanding of what work is. So I'm going to just dive right in and give you my conclusion of a definition of what I think the Bible teaches about work. Work is the imitation of God our Creator by adding value to what God has created for the purpose of reflecting God's glory. So we're going to unpack this in a minute. But I believe that this captures the essence of what we are doing when we work and also gives us our motivation for why we should work. This understanding of work means that no one is exempt from working. You don't get a pass because you're too young to get a job, or no one will hire you, or no one has given you an assignment to do. Your assignment is to look around you, take notice of something that you can do to add value to the world around you, and then do it. If it's a need that someone else has brought to you and they compensate you for your labor, great. Compensation is a natural and sometimes important component of work. But work does not depend on compensation. Work is something that any able-bodied, able-minded person should be doing. As we dive into this definition of work, first I want to clear out some of the clutter that often influences our view of work. These are some things that we often associate with work, but if we're not careful, we might incorrectly view them as defining work. For example, let's consider the fact that work is the means by which we put food on the table, clothes on our backs, and a roof over our heads. It is certainly true that while we acknowledge and give thanks to God for providing for all our needs, the means that God has ordained for that provision is our own labor. God told Adam, "By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food." This phrase in Genesis 3:19 is part of the curse, but it's not the work that's the curse. It's the fact that his toil has become painful. The cursed ground that previously gave up its fruit quite willingly now produces thorns and thistles. If we back up to Genesis 2:15, before sin entered the world, God charged Adam with cultivating and tending the garden and indicated that the garden would thereby produce fruit for him to eat. This connection between working and eating extends into the New Testament as well, with Paul instructing the Thessalonians that the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat. So clearly, one of the reasons for work is to provide for our physical needs. But this is not the only reason, and it does not define what work is. What if someone found a means of fulfilling their physical needs without requiring work? Would that justify no longer working because work isn't needed to survive? No, it would not. The fourth commandment says, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The fourth commandment is not just about resting on the Sabbath. God commands his people to work 6 days out of seven. There's no exception clause that says, unless you're able to meet your needs without having to work. Consider the parable of the rich fool found in Luke chapter 11. The subject of the parable reached a position in life where he thought he could stop working. He had enough money in his 401k and IRAs to provide himself with food, clothing, and shelter for the rest of his life. So his plan was to take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry for the rest of his days. But God called him a fool, saying, "This very night your life will be demanded from you." This was a man who misunderstood the purpose of work. He thought it was just about providing for his needs, and once that was accomplished, he could be done with work. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that it's wrong to retire from a job. Another thing that work isn't is simply being gainfully employed. There are plenty of people in the world who are gainfully employed but aren't actually doing much work. Along those same lines, there are lots of people who do all sorts of hard work day in and day out without having an employer and getting paid for their work. We often use work as a synonym for employment, but the reality is that work and earning a wage from an employer are two different things. Someone might have a hard time finding a wage-paying job, but that does not exempt them from the biblical exhortation to be fruitful, to work. And when it comes to leaving the realm of wage-paying employment, if your goal is to retire young and pursue leisure activities for the rest of your days, that's a problem. But if you no longer need the wages or your body is simply wearing out, there's nothing wrong with retiring from a career in order to invest one's remaining labor in different areas. One more thing that doesn't count as work is simply staying busy. Idleness and laziness are vices that the Bible condemns, and work serves as an antidote to those vices, but simply having things to do or keeping oneself busy does not qualify as work. Imagine someone named Kitty, a character on some TV show called The Real Housewives of Somewhere. She is super busy. After her yoga class, she has a spa treatment. She somehow manages to squeeze in getting her hair and nails done before her book club, but she can't stay and chat because she has an appointment to meet with Stefan to pick out curtains for the kids' pool house bathroom. She's very busy, but we wouldn't confuse that with her working, right? Work requires productivity. The Apostle Paul warns the Thessalonians and his disciple Timothy that those who are busy without being productive have not escaped the vice of idleness. 2 Thessalonians 3:11 refers to those who walk in idleness, not busy at work, but busybodies. The Greek word here that's translated busybodies is periergazomai. So peri you might recognize from words like perimeter or peripheral, means around. Ergazomai is where we get the word work, or means work, is where we get the word ergonomics. So a busybody is somebody who circles around work. They're like mosquitoes who are buzzing in your ear while you're trying to work. They come around those who are doing work, and they watch, and they comment, and they ask questions. They interfere with work, but they don't actually do work. They're busy, but Paul says that what they're doing is actually idleness. To qualify as work, they need to be productive. Their activity needs to produce something of value. When someone invests effort in activities that don't produce value, that's just wasted effort, not work. We have a phrase or two for this. If we say that someone is polishing brass on a sinking ship or rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, what we mean is that they're applying effort to something that is not producing anything of value. What they are doing might have value in a different place or time, but their current effort is misplaced and of no value. Real work produces value. Because I'm an engineer and I like science, let me give you a scientific analogy. In scientific terms, work is a transfer of energy from one object or system to another. When you increase the kinetic and/or the potential energy of an object, you've done work on that object. But if you apply a force on an object without changing its energy, you haven't done any work. So for example, in front of our house, we have a pretty large landscaping rock, and earlier this year, I was hoping to move it to a different location. So I squatted down, and I got my arms around this big rock, and I tried to move it. I tried to roll it, I tried to slide it, I got a rope around it, and I tried to drag it, but no matter what I did, it was too heavy for me to move. I expended a lot of energy, But all that effort just made me hot and sweaty and tired and out of breath. I failed to do any work on that rock. If it had been a much, much smaller rock, something that I could have lifted easily, then I could have expended less effort but actually done work. I could have increased its kinetic energy by putting it in motion. I could have increased its potential energy by lifting it above the ground. But it's the fact that it's not the effort that determines the work. It's whether or not you actually increase the energy of what you're working on. So take that analogy and apply it in a spiritual or theological sense. And it's a similar concept, except that instead of measuring an increase in energy, what we're measuring is an increase of value in accordance with what God says is good. All right, now that we have ruled out some things that are inadequate for defining work, let's come back to the definition I gave earlier. Work is the imitation of God our Creator by adding value to what God has created. When God commanded Adam and Eve to work, and when he commanded the Israelites to work, he was commanding them to be imitators of him. The fourth commandment includes a because. God commanded his people to work 6 days out of seven because he worked 6 days out of seven when he created our world. The work that God did on those 6 days was not a means to provide something that he needed. God lacks nothing. He didn't do it just to stay busy. He wasn't bored. He didn't need something to keep him occupied. He did it to produce something of value, something good. God didn't just create a blank slate, something that could maybe be used for good down the road. No, he created something that was good and of value. And when he was done, he tasked his creation with spreading and increasing the value of what he had made. Be fruitful and multiply, he said. Go out and create more value. The creation account in Genesis 1 indicates that the way God added value to his creation was twofold. First, he brought order where there was disorder, and he filled what was empty. The initial state of the earth was formless and void. It was disordered, and it was empty. And God then increased the value of the earth by introducing order and filling the emptiness. On days 1 through 3, God brought order and structure. He says, this goes here, and this goes here. He separated the light from the darkness, creating day and night. He created time out of timelessness. He gave order and structure to the waters, separating the waters of the heavens from the waters of the earth. He gave structure to the land and the seas. In Psalm 107, this act is rendered poetically as a rebuke against the disorder. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass. Each day, God introduced more order and structure into his creation. Then he looked at this order and structure that he had created, and he said, this is good. This has value. On the next 3 days of creation, God took that order and structure that he had formed, and he filled it. He increased the value of his creation by adding more good things on top of the good design that he had created on the first 3 days. He added value to day and night by giving the sun and moon to fill and rule over the structure he had created. He added value to the waters by filling them with fish, to the sky by filling it with birds. He filled the land with living creatures, first animals and then man. Then he looked at the structure that he had filled with additional things of value, and he said, this is good. On each of the 6 days of creation, God increased the value of what he had made. His work moved creation from a state of disorder to a state of order to a state capable of supporting life to a state filled with life. And when God was finished, he gave instructions to keep this progression of value going. Be fruitful and multiply. Continue filling the earth with value. He commanded Adam to maintain and enforce order and structure in the world, to subdue the earth and have dominion over it, to add value by taming what's wild, by controlling what's random and chaotic. So that's our task. We have been made in God's image to be imitators of him, and he has commanded us to work. So we imitate God by adding value to what God has given us. This does not mean that what God has created is lacking value or insufficient in any way. Just like our job of glorifying God does not imply that God is lacking glory and we are somehow participating in getting his glory up to the level where it needs to be. We cannot increase God's glory, but we can spread it and reveal it to those who do not recognize it. When we add value to God's creation, we are not fixing or finishing something imperfect that God started and left half finished. We recognize that there is no limit to the goodness of God. And so, there is no limit when it comes to spreading or multiplying what is good. Work is taking the knowledge of what God has declared good and figuring out how to make more of it. What can I do to increase the value of this product or service by making it more effective at delivering benefits consistent with what God has called good? Where is there chaos or clutter that stands in the way of progress? And what can I do to bring it under control? Work is finding ways to increase what God has called good. So let's think a little bit about what this might look like in the workforce. If you work for some corporation, as I do, have you ever questioned whether your work is truly creating something of real value, or are you just collecting a paycheck? I spend most of my days working to maintain and improve computer systems and software that enable my employer to build and sell electric motors and generators. Does that have value in God's eyes? If my efforts allow my employer to sell more products at a higher profit margin because we can design and build them faster and easier with fewer errors and higher quality, is that something that God cares about? Or am I just helping line the pockets of corporate executives and Wall Street investors? These are things I think about. But we have to keep in mind that our inclination sometimes to think of secular employment of being of less value than ministry is not necessarily true. Remember the sermon that Wendell gave 2 weeks ago about Platonism and Gnosticism. This idea that the physical world has no real value and only spiritual things are inherently good, that's not from Scripture. Remember that God called the physical world good, and he has given us instructions to maintain and improve the physical world. Part of Christ's redemption of creation is restoring the goodness of the physical world to undo the damage that was caused by sin. The Bible affirms the goodness and value of lots of different vocations, some directly, some indirectly. Take food, for example. We need it to survive, but the Bible also affirms the goodness of enjoying a banquet with a wide variety of foods prepared by a talented chef. The Bible also affirms a marketplace where goods and services are exchanged fairly to the benefit of all those involved. There's no expectation that we all grow and prepare our own food. So farmers are good and necessary, but also think about all the other industries and vocations that support, enable, and enhance the production and distribution of food. Tractors and other farm implements, irrigation systems, storage systems, transportation systems, electricity, refrigeration, grocery stores, restaurants, and a near endless stream of other products and industries have evolved, at least in part, to add value to the production and distribution of food. And each of those products and industries branch out into their own network of related fields. Now, on the flip side, just because an activity is related to the production and distribution of food doesn't necessarily mean that it is adding value. Some activities that are done in the name of food production might make our food less safe, or they come at the expense of reducing value elsewhere. Cruelty to animals, destruction of the environment, promotion of gluttony, things like that. So we need to use wisdom, and we need to evaluate all aspects of what God has commended as good. Just like the production and distribution of food explodes into this vast array of ways in which we can add value to that process, the same is true with all other good things. Maybe your skills and interests are best suited to helping the animal kingdom fulfill their mandate to be fruitful and multiply. Maybe you add value to the world as a musician or an artist, creating works of beauty that reflect the order and design that God has called good. Maybe you add value by shaping minds as a teacher or counselor. Anything that God has declared as good, we can look to see whether there is some way in which we can multiply and spread that goodness. A favorite verse of mine is Proverbs 25:2, which says, "It is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings is to search things out." So I think it's a regal endeavor to engage in this divinely commissioned treasure hunt to uncover whatever we can about God and his creation, to add value by organizing and disseminating the knowledge we acquire, and then using this knowledge to fill the world with good things that reflect God's glory. This pursuit of knowledge and applying it to increase our ability to produce good things has led to many technological advances and the production of quite a few innovations that enhance our lives. But we should be careful not to view these innovations as labor-saving devices, but rather as labor-shifting devices. Our goal should not be to escape or avoid work. Rather, we recognize that all resources are limited, and some resources can be used more effectively in different ways. Technological advances allow us to be more productive by applying our labor more effectively somewhere else. Finally, it should go without saying, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway, our definition of what is good and what has value must come from God, not from the world. The world's values are messed up. And as a result, there are jobs out there that destroy value instead of creating value. Any such job that requires or encourages the commission of sin, that promotes unbiblical, anti-Christian practices or beliefs, is a job that is antithetical to a Christian view of work. And there are bound to be gray areas too, activities that might be lawful in and of themselves, but whether or not the job is actually adding value to the world might be in doubt. For example, I think we can safely affirm that there's goodness and value in undergarments. But is that really what Victoria's Secret is selling? We can affirm that there is value in the production and limited consumption of alcoholic beverages. But some might question whether the industry as a whole is adding value or destroying value. What about the gaming industry, body modification, modeling, the entertainment industry as a whole? Possibly you can build a case for or against some of these areas of work. In some cases, it might boil down to a matter of personal conscience. But in every case, we should seek to be wise. Where there is doubt, seek out pastoral guidance and the counsel of others who are mature in their faith. I could imagine there might be scenarios where elders would strongly discourage someone from entering a particular line of work, but at the same time would not subject them to church discipline if they chose to ignore that counsel. It's not my desire to burden your conscience with worry over whether or not your line of work is sufficiently valuable in God's eyes compared to some other line of work. But I do encourage that we all think about what God values. Colossians 3:23 says, "Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men." We should always have in mind what God values, because that's who we're working for. And it's true, God values things that we might be tempted to think of as mundane and ordinary. Our goal should not be to think of, well, what's the most valuable thing possible, and then we all quit our jobs to become full-time evangelists. Some of us can add more value to the world by working in a trade than by attempting to be a pastor. And of course, not all work is career-oriented. There is plenty of God-honoring work to be done in our homes and families. Even housework adds value because all resources are limited, and the Bible affirms making the most of our limited resources. Since we should not waste resources, we can be more generous with the resources that we have if we take good care of them. Things like washing our clothes, vacuuming our floors, and cleaning our bathrooms aren't just things we do for cosmetic reasons. We know that dirt and oils and other materials need to be cleaned away because our things will last longer that way. So by doing such preventative maintenance, we're improving the value and making the best use of our limited resources. There's much more that could be explored as we seek to understand what value God places on the opportunities we face each day. My goal has simply been to get us to think about why we should work and what work actually is. Our pursuit of imitating God by adding value to his creation. Now, to do that, we need to understand what God values and how our activities can multiply and spread those things that God values. But when we are capable of spreading goodness and increasing the value of the world around us, we are fulfilling the great commandment to love God and love our neighbor. In closing, I want to look at one more example from Scripture that emphasizes the importance of adding value to what God has given us. I assume we're all familiar with the parable of the talents told in Matthew 25 with a similar telling in Luke 19. In this parable, Jesus describes a man who leaves home for a time, and while he is gone, he charges his servants with having rule and dominion over his property. Before he leaves, he gives each servant a sum of money, 5 talents, 2 talents, and 1 talent. Commentators say that a talent was a measure of weight equivalent to around 6,000 denarii, and 1 denarius was a typical day's wage. So 1 talent was a considerable amount of money, roughly 20 years' worth of wages. So the master leaves, and 2 of the servants went to work. The servant who had been given 5 talents was able to earn 5 more, doubling his master's money. The servant who had been given 2 talents went to work, was able to earn 2 more, also doubling his master's money. But the other servant, who had been given 1 talent, remember what he did? He dug a hole in the ground and he buried the money. He didn't lose it. He didn't squander it on bad investments or wasteful spending. He simply buried it. And when the master returned, this servant presents his master with the full amount, almost as if he's proud of himself for not losing any. Eugene Peterson in The Message paraphrases Matthew 25:25 as the servant saying, "I found a good hiding place and secured your money, boss. Here it is, safe and sound, down to the last cent." But what is the master's response? The master says, "You wicked, lazy servant. You should have at least deposited my money in the bank where it would have earned some interest." The servant was condemned as worthless because he did nothing to increase the value of what he was entrusted with. So let us be good and faithful servants who know what our master values and imitate our master by multiplying the value of what belongs to him.